Chapter 17. The Girl with a Magic Smile. Napoleon rode his matchingly proportioned but nevertheless magnificent white charger, Marengo Pie, a souvenir of his Egyptian campaign, as was his Mameluke bodyguard jogging ahead, while Laplace and Shaun had to slalom the fallout on foot. Their dignity was even more rarefied by the narrowness of the ways through the old town centre, which at times obliged them to fall behind the general first consul, and scurry back alongside his horse to catch his next whimsical observation. They were superseded and, I guess, underseded by at least 50 death-for-glory outriders with lances raised suggestively, their blue banners flashing their self-awareness through the medium of bright sunlight. Feeling a little hot in his image-accessory green coat, his lucky sabre bouncing at his side, Napoleon squeezed down the extending ends of his enormous hat to allow him to pass through the narrowest alleyways, and gave the tricolour pennant on its front a cavalier spin for good measure. "Passing through nonchalantly like this gives my newly acquired subjects an adoration up," Napoleon called down to Shaun and Laplace through a professional politician's grimace, while waving with studied superiority at the few emotionless ongawkers who had bothered to turn out. The first consul dictated to his secretary, who was riding on a desk mule close behind.
"Bourienne, right. The victorious French Legion rode through the cheering and near-hysterical crowds, whose mood was appropriate to a people who have embraced fresh liberation at tax-exempted prices."
"Got that, Your Excellency."
"Don't forget to add the H's. Then send it off as a beacon text message to be in the papers in Paris by the day after tomorrow."
They were passing a small convent, whose occupants had come out to see if there was any new trade and soul-saving to be had from the tourist influx. "You know you're hitting it big when you are a nun event," commented Laplace, and in the process of laughing at his own wit, failed to avoid yet another large steaming dollop that fell behind the First Consul's decorum-challenged horse. "He likes to leave his mark," snorted Laplace, as he wiped his shoes on a peasant given to rash cynicism. By 1800, the haunted house had lost its regal isolation, now caught up in the town's skirts flung out towards the valleys rivuletting down from the mountains to the north. To Shaun's added joy, he could see that immediately beyond the haunted house estate now stood what would one day be his family home. Brand new, garden pristine, touchily French and trompe-l'oeiled to the hilt.
"Your house, n'est-ce pas? I had it built quietly," said Napoleon. "Not that you can ever build a house quietly."
"I see you have already tried to enter the haunted house," said Shaun, indicating the piles of skeletons in the courtyard, in blue with red trim guards' uniform jackets, their white legs yellowing for two different reasons, the tricolour flag still upholding a limp optimism in the breeze. Something else was different to when he had last been here. Just as Galileo had told him there would be, there was an inscription on the arch over the door, which read, AVO. "Do you know what that means?" Shaun asked Laplace.
"Yes, it is Leonardo's logo, Amor Vincit Omnia, Love Conquers All." "Let us go into the other house," commanded the First Consul.
Leaving the cuirassiers outside, polishing each other with Factor V cream, Napoleon led Laplace and Shaun next door into what would one day become the Serlepierre family home. Napoleon's Mameluke bodyguard ran ahead, as always, to check the coast was clear of assassins and cosmetic sales ladies. When he touched the door, Shaun's fingers lingered to caress its wooden planks. He'd never felt so in tune with anything so much in all his life. When he saw the familiar staircase and archway leading to the kitchen at the rear, his childhood memories surged, and his homesickness threatened to burst some nostalgia dike and drown him in tears. While Napoleon and his entourage of officers and hangers-on general inspected the kitchen staff, and then the nibblies cupboard in the pantry, Shaun stood aside and let himself be transported. He could see his mother coming, as beautiful as ever, down the curved staircase, her elegant hand skipping playfully along the deeply lacquered banister, her face alive and inviting news of his day. Napoleon broke in on his revelry.
"New curtains, don't you think, Laplace?"
"You forget, Your Excellency, that I am no longer your Minister for Interiors.
Oh, what are you then?
I am between titles.
Don't worry. When I have created the French Empire, I will make you a count.
Why a count? How else does one honor a mathematician?
I would suggest you write a sequel to that book of yours. Mécanique Céleste. Good title. Good characters. Sun, Moon, and the other guys.
Planets? That's them. Ripping good read.
The ending is left just hanging though. It has me in suspenders.
No one knows how it ends.
Why don't you do what everyone else does? Invent stuff to fill the gaps in knowledge. I suggest you tweak future history a little in our flavor. Start by planting a French flag on the moon.
I doubt very much that any men will ever be so arrogant as to plant a flag of just a single nation on a celestial orb.
You might be right, sir, but the French dominated solar system. Somehow, je ne sais pas.
Napoleon gripped a handful of air passionately.
Sounds right to me.
But ours is just one of many solar systems.
Mad as that sounds, that is the basis for a good political plot. The French solar system conquers the universe under the command of a demigod.
Napoleon moved to the base of the stairs and looked up it as if it were a launch pad. Laplace put on his pouting, stubborn boy face. But in my book, there is no god at all.
No, Monsieur Biggie?
Napoleon turned and stared him in the lower chest. I had no need of that hypothesis, the ex-marquis replied. Napoleon twirled his forefinger in the air.
Then what, in the name of all celestial anarchy, keeps it all turning?
Well, thanks to Newton and his calculus, we know the cosmos didn't need anything more than just an initial good hard shove. Napoleon began to walk up the stairs. Laplace followed, but made sure to stay at least three steps below.
It is like Archimedes and his lever.
Napoleon stopped halfway up and addressed the generals and omusrans below.
Give me a place to stand and I will move the world.
Everybody, sycophantic by nature, did what came naturally and applauded. Pronouncement over, Napoleon returned to Laplace.
Ah, the Greeks were masters of the chiseled soundbite. But who shoved the universe at the beginning? Nothing can shove itself, surely.
I have an idea that the cosmos never started as such.
Ah, so that means it never ends.
Ends? Yes. I suppose that no end in sight would be the expected corollary of such a philosophy.
Never ends. Yes, that's good for a Galactic Empire trilogy.
Actually, I was planning a pentalogy.
5 books. Good. I like ambition. With a serial like this, I can sow dreams and grow a fresh crop of cannon fodder for next year's annexation harvest. Now, this Death Star zingy of yours.
Blob of Dark.
Blob of Dark. I really have to find a better name, you know. How does it fit into it all?
That's exactly the point. It doesn't fit anywhere. Not anymore. You see, the Blob of Dark is a bit like an empire that gets too big for its boots, like Atlantis collapses under its own weight.
Not so pleasing. I don't know if that will play well with the pleb market. Still, I am not the writer, just a humble conqueror.
And reality? Asked Laplace, sweet innocently.
Not my strong suit, sighed Napoleon,
the conqueror and loser of Egypt.
How are you on reality, Marquis?
In all probability, it all comes down to probability.
Meaning you're uncertain? You scientists are so proud of your uncertainty.
Uncertainty could be the basis of a great principle one day. For now, let us just say that with probability you can explain everything but foresee nothing.
But I already have a license to guess. I have to sound sure of myself to the people.
Yes, but guessing usually leads men stumbling down the path to explanations that include mystic creatures and omnipotent creators. Mathematical probability, used properly, would liberate man from such devices. They found Sean sitting daydreaming on the top stair.
Ah, here he is. Sean, come along. I have something to show at you.
Sean followed Napoleon and the ex-marquis up the next flight. They went into what would one day be Nonno's doing science room, which had a French window that gave onto an ornate balcony which overlooked the garden of the haunted house. On an easel by the window was a cover which profiled a small frame underneath.
"Et voilà," said Napoleon, with as much dramatic cliché power he could muster, and pulled off the cover.
And there she was, the Mona Lisa. Sean had to bite his lip so as not to cry when he thought of Jenny, and how she had sacrificed herself for him on the London Bridge.
"Ah, the Monet, is she not voluptuous, isn't it?" exclaimed the First Consul. "Now tell me she was not painted from the balcony of that house, Laplace."
Laplace came over and compared the background of the painting to the view from the balcony, the landscape extending over the lake into the mountains to the south, the last line of southern Alps before the plain of Lombardy. After some time, Laplace turned slowly, nodding his head.
"Yes, yes, it is possible, just." "What do you mean, just? It is a match parfait."
"Not entirely. The mountains, the lake, its distinctive fork there, the road leading to it, yes, they are all correctly collocated. However, there is a bridge in the painting, whereas on this side of Lugano there's not even a river, never mind a bridge."
"Sean, tell us, was this painting done here or no?"
"Yes, at least on the balcony next door." Laplace was unconvinced. "So, maybe our eyewitness can explain why this painting has such a magnetic effect on people, why anybody who gazes upon her immediately falls in love with her."
"Yes, can you enlighten us, Monsieur Renaissance man?" grinned Napoleon.
"I don't know. All I did was mix the paint for Leonardo."
"And what did you use?"
Suddenly some sunlight peeked through Sean's comprehension haze.
"I used thyme eggshells for the pinky brown of her mouth."
"Yes, the effect is strongest around her mouth. It is consistent with my theory."
"What theory?" asked Sean.
Laplace eyebrowed an inquiry at Napoleon.
"Oh, go on, tell him," returned his boss.
"The shells of the stone eggs consist of a very rare form of porphyry, known in the philosopher trade as the one stone, the very same eggs used by oracles because they are known to induce hallucinations as well as glimpses of the past and future."
"I see," replied Sean. "Do you think it's true that the stone eggs really contain tempus albumen, liquid thyme?"
"My preferred metaphor is thyme magma, more correctly a pyroclastic encapsulation of chronoplasma. The occurrence of the stone eggs goes back to the beginning of little-known history. They are also associated with surges in interest in geometry, the search for what Euclid and Vitruvius called the golden ratio, what Leonardo and Pacioli called the divine proportions, and their best-selling erotic geometry derivatives. As to where the eggs come from, we know there have been different sources, but probably never more than one at any time. We can track them through the shifts in epicenters of sudden spurts in the progress of civilization. India and China clearly had theirs. More our way, the oldest evidence of a source we have is somewhere in Wales. The culture of divination that arose built many of the stone circles to be found in Britain and Western France. Then we find the source in Egypt. Legend has it at the end of the ancient Via Porphyritz. Attempts to build perfect geometric structures incorporating the stone, which encapsulates the eggs, led to the construction of the pyramids, within which, it was hoped, the fantastic power that was generated could be contained. The Greeks were irresistibly drawn to Egypt, and it can be quite easily seen that the loss of the Egyptian egg source coincides with the decline of the Hellenic Egyptian civilization and the rise of Rome.
But what is it? Asked Sean,
totally ecstatic to be listening to the great Pierre-Simon de Laplace give a lecture in his Nonno's Doing Science room.
No idea. Your guess is almost as good as mine.
Greek mythology is full of suggestions of the presence of a hot, bubbling lake deep beneath the surface of the earth. Newton tells us gravity will be denser down there, quite gooey, in fact, so wouldn't the pressure also compress time? And at some point, the time goo might be forced towards the surface like, well, lava.
Yes, like lava.
And as the pressure and temperature decreases, small bubbles of it could become encrusted with containment rock, like any phenocryst. Only this rock is itself transformed by its contents. The results would be the thyme eggs.
What you have just described, Citizen Laplace, is a thyme volcano, nodded Napoleon thoughtfully.
Laplace had always thought Napoleon had been his most promising student. Exactly. Releasing its magmatic pressure through a weak point. A crack, a fracture in the crust? Not even. A pinprick would suffice. Any idea what would comprise such a pin? Well, whatever it is, it would cause some very localized, very focused disturbance to the natural arrangement of space, the material occupying it, and the vis viva, or living force, that gives it action. Energy, nodded Sean. Do you have any idea at all as to when the source of the time eggs moved from Egypt to Europe? Laplace looked at Sean meaningfully. I can tell you precisely when it happened. The year -212. Archimedes, cried Sean. The last known use of Egyptian pink was the Rosetta Stone, carved soon after the fall of Syracuse. And that is what Rosetta means, a little pinky. But, continued Sean, isn't the Rosetta Stone grey? Only the basalt decoy we left for the British. After this, there was no more one stone to be had in Egypt. Eventually, the cult of the oracles died out. And moved to Europe? Yes, nodded Laplace. The crossing of the pink eventually gave birth to an alternative cult of oracles here in Europe. There's been a non-stop stream of claims and counterclaims to the Rosy Crossing, or Rosicrucian, trademark. Just then, Bourienne entered, and, as inconspicuous as a man with a 20-kilogram desk around his neck can be, whispered into Napoleon's ear. Napoleon nodded and whispered something conspiratorially back. Sean fancied he heard, "Get them to wait in the conspiracy room. Leave your desk here." He then turned to Laplace and Sean. "Gentlemen, I see you have lots to discuss. I really must go. Affairs of state, a country or two to annex, you know how it is." "I used to think I did," replied Sean.